The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 7th of July 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz.
As part of the programme's partnership with Allianz, we are bringing you stories that demonstrate Allianz's commitment to securing people's lives. After all, for 130 years all around the globe, Allianz has been working hard to do just that, to give courage to its customers for what's ahead. Because Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side who provides solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Stay tuned to The Briefing to hear exactly how Allianz does it. An Allianz for life.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up, tech giants push back a bit at China's crackdown on Hong Kong. We'll have the latest from our Hong Kong bureau. Also ahead.
You know, the steps you've taken so far haven't gotten the job done, Mr. President. Fix the shortage of PPE for our healthcare workers before you tee off another round of golf.
Battle lines being drawn in the US presidential election. While Joe Biden attacks Donald Trump on basic competence, what has Trump got on Biden? And is anyone likely to listen at this point? Also ahead, we'll speak to Professor Linda Scott about her new book, The Double X Economy, and...
I'm Chiara Ramella, Monocle's culture editor, and I'll be talking about the Louvre reopening its doors and the book which, in an age of release delays, is actually coming out early.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. When China imposed a new security law on Hong Kong, it doubtless understood that there would be widespread anger and perhaps even actual consequences, and calculated that the cost was one it could meet. The bill has now begun to arrive. Several tech giants have announced that they will pause cooperation with any requests for user data from Hong Kong's police, including such behemoths as Telegram, Google, Twitter, Facebook and WhatsApp. In a perhaps more dramatic development, voguish video app TikTok has indicated that it will stop operations in Hong Kong entirely. Well, I'm joined with more from Hong Kong by Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief, James Chambers. James, first of all, I was intrigued by this announcement that they would pause cooperation with Hong Kong's police. Do we know what kind of cooperation was underway before?
We don't know exactly, and it was quite funny that one of the apps you didn't mention, Signal, said they would stop cooperating if only they'd started cooperating in the first place, and they said they don't hold any data, so they wouldn't have any to hand over. We're not quite sure what kind of data the Hong Kong police force has been requesting from these companies in the past. And what they've said now is that they're going to pause any cooperation to assess what, what this security bill means and what it means if they do hand over this kind of data to the police. I mean, loads of people use WhatsApp, and that's got end-to-end encryption. So it's not clear what kind of information, you know, Facebook, the owner of WhatsApp, could hand over.
What's your sense of what the tech giants are trying to figure out here? Are they acting out of genuine concern at what China is doing, or is this an attempt, I guess, especially in TikTok's case, to be perceived as being on the right side?
Well, I think they're being on the fence right now, because they're in the same position as most of us in Hong Kong. We don't really still know what this law requires and what it involves. It's a very, you know, it's a very thin piece of legislation for something as dramatic as a national security law. You know, we're talking 30 odd pages and 66 articles, and in those articles they require the Hong Kong government to set up certain bodies, and then those bodies need to pass certain implementation rules to, I guess, bring this into being. Now, those are starting to come out, so we're starting to see what this might mean. And so one of those rules came out yesterday, which says that, you know, police can search a premises without a warrant if it's to do with this national security law, which has got obviously alarming for a lot of people. So companies like Facebook and Google, that they're just waiting to see, you know, what this actually means, and so they don't want to be seen to be handing over information right now to the government if that's going to lead to prosecutions, and as you said, that would definitely leave them on the wrong side of public opinion, at least outside of China.
Are the tech giants also concerned with trying to balance that against the prospect of upsetting Beijing, though?
Well, you know, they're all banned in China.
So true enough.
The one tech giant that is absent from that list is Apple, and that's the one tech giant that is allowed to operate inside of mainland China. So this is not a matter of them not wanting to upset Beijing. I think this is more a matter of them not wanting to upset their global audience. Because obviously this whole thing has been huge news around the world, and these tech giants have nothing to lose in terms of upsetting Beijing. So I would definitely see this as holding on to or pleasing their audience around the world. And at the end of the day, Hong Kong is a city of 7.5 million people. Whereas, you know, these companies have hundreds of millions of users around the world. So as we're kind of seeing, Hong Kong might just find itself bearing the brunt of a lot of these things.
You said earlier that you and everybody else in Hong Kong were still trying to figure out precisely what this new security law is going to mean. Have you noticed it having any direct effect on day-to-day life already, whether that's been in actual implementation or manifestations of it, or in reaction to it in terms of protest, demonstration, etc.?
There've been zero protests. I mean, this seems to be one of those piece of legislation that kind of has or is having more of an impact on people's kind of, you know, minds and their conversations rather than any big physical changes. There've been no protests for the majority of this year because of COVID-19, and they're still not allowed to go ahead because of the COVID-19 restrictions. So we'll have to wait and see if and when those get raised, and police perhaps do grant authority for a legal protest rally, whether huge numbers of people will turn out. But as of today, and since the law came into effect, you know, almost this time last week, it's been very normal on the streets in Hong Kong. Everyone's been going about their business. But there've been just news coming out every day that's just causing more and more alarm. Like the libraries taking books off the shelves to see whether they fall foul of this security bill, and then this latest news today that TikTok is pulling out of Hong Kong and pulling its app, you know, off the App Store, even though that's I'd say that's a bit of a red herring, because it is, after all, a Chinese company, and I imagine this is more of a corporate strategy than anything else. It does continue to raise alarm bells here, but when you go out on the streets, it's like Hong Kong was in 2018, you know, before all the protests of last year. So it appears very normal, but I think the damage being done here is very much in people's minds.
James Chambers in our Hong Kong Bureau, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It's now just 119 days until American voters will decide whether or not to persist with the presidency of Donald Trump. If current form is any guide, any hope that this will be 119 days of rarefied and respectful philosophical discourse seems forlorn. President Trump has already signaled that he intends to tackle his presumptive opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, the only way he knows, with personal insult, accusations of malfeasance, and general delirious hurling of smears. This worked, in fairness, against Hillary Clinton, but will it work against Biden, who people seem, generally, to actually quite like? Well, I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's US election correspondent, Thomas Lewis. Thomas, first of all, Trump has, of course, been beating up on Joe Biden for a while. He's already patented the nickname Sleepy Joe. He has tried to impugn Biden's family to the extent that it got him impeached. Do we understand yet what insults Trump thinks are actually going to land?
I don't think we do at the moment, Andrew. And I think, as we saw with Hillary Clinton back in 2016, I think there will have been a sense to some degree that the name calling, as you described in the introduction there, the sort of stoking of the suspicion around Hillary Clinton's having various things to hide throughout her career, it sort of took him by surprise that they landed so successfully. And I think, therefore, there might be a bit of a sort of, you know, casting off into the darkness to see what does stick. And therefore, we might see a big array of insults and accusations coming Joe Biden's way from Donald Trump. Because I think if you look at, you know, what happened last time in 2016, Donald Trump didn't necessarily have a very rigid strategy, if I can put it that way. But the more outrageous things that he did stick and did chime with those people, many of them at least, who ended up voting for him. And I would suspect that that is the strategy that he will look to undertake again this time around.
I mean, we have seen some memos leaked from inside the Biden camp in the last few days. How much of a measure do they give of how concerned or otherwise the Biden camp is?
I think they're quite interesting. I think if you speak to sort of many voters, they don't necessarily get so deep into the weeds as being sort of set alight, if you like, by an internal memo that's been leaked to the press. Bloomberg News has received several memos from within the Biden campaign, which are responses to these personal attacks by Donald Trump, and they make light of them. They suggest that these attacks aren't landing, that they aren't really chiming with people, given the extraordinary things that are swirling around the United States at the moment. The economy, of course, the rising number of coronavirus infections, and also the Black Lives Matter protests and the calls for police reform that are still roiling many cities across the country. And I think they might have a point, in fact, by saying that by the name calling, Sleepy Joe, as you mentioned earlier, that they just really aren't catching on. They aren't sticking to Trump's opponents as they once did. But I think he will try and continue to do it, because I'm not sure really what else he has at the moment, or at least that would be the sense from his opponents at least.
What are we beginning to learn about what strategy Joe Biden is going to pursue? I mean, he is, for some of the reasons you mentioned, or at least one of the reasons you mentioned, going to be extremely circumscribed as a campaigner. There won't be any big election rallies. He'll be likely doing very little meeting and greeting of the voter in the street. Is his whole thing just going to be letting Trump flail and rant and do the thing of not interrupting your enemy while they're making a mistake?
I think there'll be an element of that, but I do think that was the strategy that Hillary Clinton undertook last time around, and that wasn't particularly successful for her. If you look at Joe Biden's online presence of his campaign, for example, some of the attacks of Donald Trump are pretty explicit there, and they don't veer into the kind of language that we're used to from Donald Trump, but they're pretty blunt in their assessment of how he is failing the country on so many fronts. I think, you know, he's obviously been forced, Joe Biden, into running an insurgent presidential campaign from home for the last few months. No other person who's run for the presidency has been in that position before. There are lots of indications that that kind of quiet presence, largely online, not out and about, has actually served Joe Biden rather well. There seem to be a lot of studies that suggest that people, you know, aren't sort of fired up by Joe Biden as a candidate, but they do see him as someone to be respected largely, someone who is the adult in the room, if you like. And I think that has served Joe Biden very well, and he's dealt with that very well. He's launched his own podcast during lockdown. He's made addresses via video link on some of the big, more grim milestones in the United States over the past couple of months. And those things have really cut through a lot of the sort of more mercurial, more angry political moments that Donald Trump has found himself in and has indeed encouraged, I suppose, on many occasions.
I mean, what indication are we getting where we are now, 119 days out, from what polls are telling us? Because polls and ratings seem to be the one thing that Trump has taken any consistent interest in throughout his presidency, albeit that he's been a bit selective in which ones he chooses to pay attention to.
Absolutely. And I think that's why we're seeing this ramping up of attacks on Joe Biden now, because the polls are really pretty grim reading for Donald Trump. I think a word of caution for lots of us, if you think back to 2016, when the national polls had Hillary Clinton quite comfortably in the lead for pretty much the majority of the race, only for her to be defeated on election day, albeit by a very narrow margin in the Electoral College. I think what lots of commentators are suggesting now is that there's a ramping up of local polling, and that it's actually that data that will be more instructive. So the New York Times, for example, is working in more local data into its national polls. And what some of those local polls are finding is something that matches the national picture at the moment, at least. So I think whereas the 2016 campaign was criticised for having ignored what people in the middle of the country, for example, those who are grinding out a living and had felt left behind by the political process, I think this time around, if you look at the local polling and the focus on that, that will be an attempt to try and not get sort of caught out by that surprise again, and to actually see what people in the country are feeling. And at the moment, they aren't feeling very much at all in a positive way for President Donald Trump, Andrew.
Thomas Lewis, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing, brought to you in association with Allianz.
Creating a sense of purpose is key to keeping staff motivated. And as the world's largest insurer and asset manager, Allianz ensures that its 150,000 global employees are in a position to safeguard its customers' futures and offer more than mere cover. Serge Raffard is Group Strategy, Marketing, Distribution Officer at Allianz.
To be able to secure the future of our customers, we need to make sure our employees feel good and safe themselves, and then have the right tools to basically deliver on that purpose.
One key upfront investment was in IT, which allowed the number of Allianz employees working from home to rise from less than 20% to 99% as workplaces closed. Intrigued? Well, you can hear stories like this here on the show every day, or read more in the Monocle Minute every morning. Or you can find out more anytime about building an Allianz for life at allianz.com.
You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. There are many key phrases in Professor Linda Scott's new book, The Double X Economy. But key among these key phrases is sentence 1, chapter 4. No excuse justifies the suffering endured by women, but that doesn't stop people from trying. This is a state of affairs not only self-evidently grotesque, but also, as the Double X Economy demonstrates, entirely counterproductive, inasmuch as handicapping half of humanity works out pretty badly for all of humanity. humanity. Well, I'm joined now by Linda Scott, Emeritus DP World Professor for Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the University of Oxford, and the author of The XX Economy, The Epic Potential of Empowering Women. Linda, first of all, is there a straightforward way to explain what the XX economy is?
The XX economy is the global women's economy, including not only employment, but their roles as business owners, investors, donors, consumers. This economy is huge. It produces about 40% of global GDP and 50% of the world's food supply, in addition to being half the species. But it's consistently ignored by economists and governments. It suffers from a worldwide set of exclusionary mechanisms, that produce a distinctive pattern of inequality in every nation.
That's obviously the key point of the book, I think, that the huge untapped benefit that empowering women economically would represent. There's another line from the book in which you say the unlikely truth is that equal economic treatment for women would put a stop to some of the world's costliest evils while building prosperity for everyone. I was intrigued by your use of the word unlikely there. Why isn't that obvious to absolutely everybody?
I think there's several reasons. One is that people tend to, in their minds, think that women's contribution to the economy is trivial and don't want to attribute the kind of impact that women, in fact, do have. I think that the other thing is that people are somewhat more used to recently thinking of women as making a big contribution to growth, because that's been promoted a bit. But they're not as aware of the ways that women's exclusion produces some of the most horrible things the world lives with.
But the machinery that, I guess, creates and enforces that exclusion, is it your sense that that has been built over the centuries deliberately or just indifferently? Is this an expression of actual hostility to women, or is it just that they are generally not thought about?
In the beginning, and I do detail this in the book, in the beginning it has to do, I think, with not thinking of women as being fully human, that there's a pretty good record of women not being being traded basically as goods pretty much around the world in prehistoric times, not being fed well, things like that. So it goes back quite a long time. And I think it's, I don't know if you want to call it hostile. Yeah, it was always had violence behind it. So yes, I think so. I think as we come closer to this period in time that we're in, in the West particularly, it's a large extent just ignorance and indifference. Yeah.
I mean, if we think about ways in which that might be changed, does it strike you that the economics or the economic aspect might actually be important, that appeals to economic self-interest might actually work in a way that appeals to justice so far have not?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the points of the book, actually, that I hope people will take away, is that the legislation that's been put in place has been undermined quite often. It also doesn't stand up very well to custom or, you know, religious laws or whatever around the world. So I think that appealing to things like, hey, you know, you're losing GDP here, or even to a private company, you're losing profit here, which we can also show quite a bit, I think will probably work better. I think the other thing is that from the point of view of women's freedoms, I think we've been a bit naive to think that women are simply going to be free and equal because we've legislated it to be so. And a lot of freedoms are simply not, that people just can't act on them unless they have money.
I mean, In the course of the research you did for the book, do you run across examples of concrete steps that various jurisdictions, whether countries, states, or cities, might have taken that have made a difference? Because it's that, yeah, the question always provoked is, well, what can we actually do about it, ideally to speed this process up a bit?
Right. Okay, so there are some things that are rather larger than others. One is that equalizing land ownership, for example, which can often be done just by joint titling or liberalizing inheritance laws, makes a big difference. Currently, men own more than 80% of the world's farmable land. And that's not a random pattern. That's another one of those very ancient restrictions on women being able to own property. If we were to equalize that, the UN says, we would be able to feed 150 million of the world's chronically hungry. And increase GDP in agricultural economy. So that would be one that's fairly straightforward. One that I'm working, just finished working on in Uganda, the most powerful thing that we did was simply to offer household counseling sessions in equalized financial management of home budgets. And it just had a huge impact. It was no big deal. 7 sessions. Who knew?
I mean, are these steps, again, which might be accelerated or more thought about and more implemented if more women were working both in economics and in positions of political leadership? Does that self-evidently, organically generate change?
I do think it would make a big difference if women were more present in economics as a discipline and a profession. And that's because the pattern in other disciplines who have integrated not only women but gendered thinking has just transformed them. And economics is like the last one left, practically. I guess finance and computer science are too. So yeah, that would make a huge difference, just integrating that. Politics, I think, might eventually if there were enough women, but as far as I can see, the data tend to suggest that doesn't actually have as much impact as we would like to think.
Linda Scott, thank you for joining us. Linda's book, The Double X Economy, which contains all of that and multitudes more, is published by Faber and Faber. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. And finally, on today's show, our regular roundup of cultural news, for which I am joined by Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella. Chiara, first of all, a signpost moment in France's easing of lockdown. The Louvre is open again. Does that mean that once again, hundreds of people can crowd in front of the Mona Lisa, taking pictures of it for their friends who presumably don't know what the Mona Lisa looks like?
Well, interestingly, actually, some of the people who have been interviewed when they have been going to the Louvre, it reopened yesterday, have actually made precisely that point, saying that being able to look at the Mona Lisa without a huge, great crowd of people trying to take pictures has been one of the most positive aspects of the new setup of the Louvre. But as you mentioned, you know, obviously, other museums have reopened in France before this moment, and we have seen museums reopen across other countries over the last few months, but the Louvre is the most visited museum in the world, and so this is a bit of a landmark moment in terms of public arts across the world, I would say. It was closed for 16 weeks, and not all of it is reopening. 30% of the galleries will stay shut, obviously. Visitors will have to wear masks, they will have to reserve slots in advance, they will have to stand apart whilst in the galleries. And about 500 visitors will be allowed in every half hour. So the figures say that about 7,000 visited on opening day, which feels like a lot, but when you consider that about 50,000 go in on a normal kind of summer day, it's still a massive hit. The Louvre's visitors, 75% of them come from abroad, so it will be a very, very quiet season at the Louvre.
I feel like I've personally stood in shorter queues than that at the Louvre. Let's move along to the United States and President Donald Trump's ongoing role as an inadvertent catalyst of American book publishing.
Yes, indeed. So obviously, John Bolton's memoir has already made headlines, but now people are very, very eagerly awaiting Trump's niece's book, which is going to be subtitled How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. So I think what's interesting is that in this season, we've seen so many publishing delays and titles that have seen their release pushed back by months, even because there was a tentativeness around how well they would do. This is one of the few books that has actually seen its release date moved forward. So it's coming out 2 weeks earlier than it should have done because the interest is so overwhelming, despite the court case ongoing, and a restraining order, which was temporarily lifted, a temporary restraining order, which was lifted. The book is now able to come out next Monday, and I think it will captivate imaginations because it moves very, very closely to the president in a kind of familiar and psychological way that perhaps those who have read all those exposés that still have got to do with the White House and his behavior in office haven't been able to get until now. So I do think this is going to be quite a different experience and certainly a huge publishing deal.
Well, finally and briefly, moving seamlessly along to a place where this news might also be well received, i.e. your home country, Italy, where a lockdown population has rediscovered reading, it says here.
Yes, indeed. So obviously, reading, especially on paper, is something that has been questioned over the last few years. And personally, we've always been adamant that there was still an appetite for that. And it looks like the data that's been collected after lockdown has obviously ended, but about lockdown in Italy, seems to confirm that theory. The number of Italians who read has jumped up from about 29% of the population to 62% through lockdown, that is, obviously. People had more time, you would argue, and this is not just books, but it's also newspapers and magazines. But I still think this is a positive sign because historically, over the last few years, there had been controversies surrounding the fact that Italians were a country that was progressively losing almost, you know, dramatically an appetite for reading. And if anything can stick from this lockdown period, I hope it is this, that people do still want to invest in buying books and in reading magazines.
Chiara Ramella, thank you as always. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James, Yolin Goffin and Marcus Hippie. The researcher was Charlie Phil McCourt. Our studio manager today is Sam Impey. The Briefing returns at the same time tomorrow, midday London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.